Good afternoon, you're listening to KMXT 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station. Weather here in Kodiak today, it is 37 degrees Fahrenheit, mostly cloudy with a high near 39, a west wind of 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming light and variable in the afternoon. For tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 33, a west wind of 10 to 20 miles per hour. For tomorrow, going into the weekend for Saturday, partly sunny with a high near 46, a west wind around 15 miles per hour. Saturday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 35, a west wind of 5 to 10 miles per hour. For Sunday, mostly cloudy with a high near 43, a southwest wind of 5 to 15 miles per hour. Sunday night, a chance of rain after 10 p.m., mixing with snow after 1 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 31, a calm wind becoming northeast around 5 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 50%. Coming into this upcoming week Monday, a chance of rain and snow before 10 a.m., partly sunny with a high near 40, chance of precipitation is 50%. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 28, and for Tuesday, a chance of rain and snow after 10 a.m., partly sunny with a high near 38.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. Capitol Police are mourning the death of another officer killed in the line of duty this year. This afternoon, a man breached the grounds of the Capitol complex in Washington, D.C. with his vehicle. He injured two officers, one of them fatally. A short time ago, Acting Capitol Police Chief Yogananda Pittman described the suspect's actions shortly before he was shot and killed by officers.
A suspect entered what we refer to as the North Barricade of the Capitol. The suspect rammed his car into two of our officers and then hit the North Barricade barrier.
Pittman says this has been an extremely difficult time for U.S. Capitol Police, losing an officer in the line of duty during the January 6th insurrection and then another today. The head of the Minneapolis Police Department's Homicide Division called the use of police force used against George Floyd totally unnecessary. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports the murder trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin is now on hold until next week.
Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, the Minneapolis Police Department's most senior officer, reviewed the footage of body-worn cameras that recorded the events of May 25th, the day former officer Derek Chauvin held his knee on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes, according to prosecutors, and a move uncalled for, according to Zimmerman.
Because of the fact that If your knee is on a person's neck, that can kill him.
The defense asked whether police officers have to consider the entire situation when force is used, and Zimmerman agreed. The trial resumes Monday. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Minneapolis.
The CDC has updated its travel guidance for people who are vaccinated against COVID-19. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the agency says people who are fully inoculated can safely travel with the U.S. without getting tested.
Fully vaccinated people are less likely to get and spread COVID-19 and can safely travel beginning 2 weeks after getting their second shot, or their single shot in the case of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. For domestic travel, fully vaccinated people do not need to get tested, but for international travel, a test 3 to 5 days after travel is recommended. Given the virus is still circulating widely, the agency says travelers should continue to wear a mask, avoid crowds when possible, and wash hands often or use hand sanitizer. The agency continues to recommend that people who are not vaccinated avoid all non-essential travel. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
The economy gained 916,000 jobs last month, nearly double that in February, according to the Labor Department's report today. President Biden says no other administration has seen that level of job growth in the first 2 months. This is NPR.
The Sitka Sound Sack Roe Herring Facility or Fishery opened in late March after a two-year hiatus. Less than half the fleet is fishing this spring, but the seiners who have stuck around have been hauling in catches every day this week. KCAW's Catherine Rose spoke with two commercial fishermen shortly before the fishery opened about the importance of herring to their businesses and lives, and has this to report.
I'm standing on the deck of the fishing vessel Defiant, moored in Eliason Harbor. Captain Justin Peeler is showing me how the rigging works and why exactly they call it purse seining.
So on our boom is the power block. It pulls the net in evenly. We try to pull it in evenly and, you know, like I said, shrink that bowl up or shrink that purse up until we're just to the fish, and then we bring them on board.
Below the rigging is a massive black net that will make up the purse when Peeler and his crew of four haul in a set of herring. Piled high, it's taller than me and as wide as the boat.
Well, when it's wet, it's pretty heavy, but I would guess that it weighs, I would say 8,000 pounds or something like that.
The Sitkin has been fishing in the Sacro herring fishery with his family for over two decades, and the Defiant hasn't missed the fishery since it was built 42 years ago. It's one of 20 vessels participating this year, and it's an unusual time in its history. The fishery didn't open last year or the year before, largely because fish have been too young and small for their eggs to be marketable abroad. But this year, the state is predicting a record-breaking biomass of fish, which they say should be closer to marketable size. Matt Kinney runs the fishing vessel Hukilau. He says the state's forecast lines up with what he's seeing out on the water. Very large schools of fish, some in deep waters 50 to 60 fathoms below the surface, made visible with sounding and sonar equipment.
And we're doing our best as fishermen to document and try to show the public what's out there, because unlike, you know, the other species we fish, if you weren't out there looking at them through electronics, you wouldn't know that they're there.
The large anticipated biomass has led state biologists to set a guideline harvest level of over 33,000 tons of herring. Peeler says the fleet likely won't catch that much. He says the GHL isn't the same as a quota, and they don't have the processing capacity to reach that mark.
It takes freezers to freeze these things, and there is only a window of 6 to 7 days, a week, 10 days if we're lucky, or something like that, that the herring are marketable, that the roe reaches the quality that they are.
No herring fishery for 2 years has been a huge strain on the fleet and Peeler and Kenny's businesses.
It's forced me to change my business. It's affected me. You know, sure, I do multiple fisheries in Southeast Alaska, but I bought into the Defiant 7 years ago. You know, with that comes a big bill. Every fishery counts. I mean, I wouldn't buy this boat just to fish salmon. I wouldn't buy this boat just to fish herring.
Both Peeler and Kinney participate in other fisheries, and those fisheries have helped their businesses weather the off years for herring. But only with the combination of several fisheries can most fishing businesses sustain themselves long term. State management of the herring fishery has been the subject of ongoing litigation in the courts for over 2 years now, with the Sitka Tribe of Alaska arguing that subsistence harvests of herring roe are not being properly addressed. Both Kinney and Peeler say they want the stocks to survive and subsistence harvesters to meet their needs, but they also want the fishery to continue. Peeler says the permits and equipment are meant to be lasting, not temporary.
Matt's a little younger than me, and we have, you know, 20, 30 more years of this ahead of us, and our boats, our gear, our permits, and all that stuff is made to go on. It's not made to just be here for once or twice and talk about our big catch. We want these biomasses of herring or salmon or blackout or whatever we're fishing to keep going.
Kenny says that's one of the biggest misconceptions about seiners, that they're not concerned about the longevity of the herring. He says that they do care. They just trust that the state is regulating the fishery responsibly.
We're harvesting what we think the stock can handle, and all that is set by Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And it feels like people are undermining science, which is truly the last thing that we have.
And biology will determine when the herring fishery ends as well. Regardless of how much of this year's guideline harvest level of 33,000 tons is landed over the next few days, once the herring begin to spawn along the coastline of Sitka Sound, it's game over, even for this year's small but determined herring seine fleet. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
That story was part of a series of stories sharing different perspectives on the commercial herring fishery. You can find previous coverage on the website of kcaw.org, and they look forward to continuing coverage in the coming weeks. A federal permit allowing Hillcorp to drill in Cook Inlet does not account for the harm vessel noise could pose to endangered belugas there, according to a decision Tuesday from a district court judge. Cook Inlet Keeper and the Center for Biological Diversity challenged the permit in a 2019 lawsuit. Judge Shannon Gleason sided with those groups this week, ruling NOAA Fisheries did not account for how noise from Hillcorp's tugboats would cause harm to belugas when it authorized the company to work there. Bob Shavelson, advocacy director at Cook Inlet Keeper, says the decision touches on one of many impacts Hillcorp's activities have on local wildlife.
The decision clearly shows that the National Marine Fisheries Service is not doing an adequate job at protecting our marine resources.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act requires those involved in offshore oil and gas production to obtain special authorization for harming local marine life, known as incidental take, as long as its impact on wildlife is negligible. Hillcorp received that authorization from NOAA Fisheries in 2019 for its five-year plan for exploration and development in the inlet. But in its own recovery plan for the endangered species, NOAA says noise from tugboats is a threat to beluga whales. That's partly because belugas rely on echolocation to find food and communicate with each other. The judge's decision requires the parties involved to propose remedies to the noise problem from tugboats within 14 days of the March 30th order. Shavelson says Inlet Keeper will be in touch with its lawyers to decide what to propose.
There's so many different impacts affecting the Cook Inlet beluga whale. It really is that death by a thousand cuts. And some things, you know, like climate change, are a lot more difficult to get a handle on. But we know that pervasive ship noise, seismic air guns, toxic dumping, we know those things are having a negative effect on beluga whales, so we should reduce and eliminate them where we can.
The court did uphold part of NOAA's ruling regarding mitigation measures for seismic surveying around belugas. Representatives from NOAA Fisheries and Hillcorp declined request for comment. Hillcorp is currently the biggest producer of oil and gas in Cook Inlet. The Texas-based company owns several federal lease blocks in the inlet and is planning for a geohazard survey on some of those tracts this summer. Contractors plan to break ground on a multi-million-dollar airport project in Gustavus this April, but newly discovered toxic chemicals at the site make the state-run project more complicated. And as Claire Strempel with Alaska's Energy Desk reports, some residents don't think environmental oversight goes far enough to keep them safe.
The upgrade at Gustavus's state-run airport is a decade in the making, but just a few years ago, contaminants were discovered at the airport and in water, soil, and wells around the remote southeast community. The contaminants are called PFAS, a group of toxic chemicals found in firefighting foam that used to be required at airports and defense sites. They're known as forever chemicals because they don't break down. There's evidence they're linked to cancer, thyroid problems, and other ill health effects. In Gustavus, some residents are speaking out because equipment is already showing up for the $20 million federally funded project that is scheduled to break ground this month, and state agencies are still gauging the PFAS risks.
I would like to trust state government to do the right thing at the airport, knowing that there is a contamination present and that it has been impactful to the community, but I don't have that confidence.
Nicole Gruey is among a number of residents leery of a project that will move contaminated soil. And to be clear, the state has done what it's legally required to do. There just aren't many legal requirements. More than a dozen Gustavus households have been drinking bottled water for years since they learned their wells are poisoned with PFAS from runoff. Gruey lives across the street from the airport, and she's worried the contamination could spread. She and members of the local PFAS advocacy organization are pushing for more accountability from the state.
There is no permanent disposal plan for the contaminated ground. There is no permanent solution to this. They found the contamination. There are plumes across the community.
The state's Department of Transportation runs the airport and is responsible for the contaminants, but it doesn't have to clean them up. It does have a plan to keep contaminated soil from spreading toxins in Gustavus. State regulators approved the plan in early March, but Gruey says the plan doesn't go far enough because it doesn't test the airport runways for PFAS or sample enough of the surrounding soil.
I never thought I would be at a place where I have to advocate on behalf of myself and the community to ensure the state does not do further harm.
We're not going to do any construction work until we resolve those issues.
DOT spokesperson Sam Dapsovich says the agency takes community concerns seriously. It even tested some of the asphalt at the contaminated site after Gruey voiced her concern. That's a step beyond what they're required to do. State regulators say it may be a first.
You know, it is a rather new, issue that we have to deal with, and we're figuring it out as we go.
DOT officials point to regulation by another state agency, the Department of Environmental Conservation, that signs off on their safety measures. State environmental regulators don't typically inspect construction at contaminated sites that they've already checked out. It's up to DOT to comply with state regulations. And there's motivation to do that. The agency is responsible for any more contamination. PFAS are known to be toxic, but they aren't considered a hazardous waste substance. There are federal guidelines for how to manage PFAS, but no regulations. And the state is actually out in front of the federal government on this one. But State Senator Jesse Kiel says Alaska's regulations aren't enough to keep residents of Gustavus safe.
Right now, the state of Alaska has some very, very weak regulations. They really only cover two of these forever chemicals, and at surprisingly high levels.
Kiel says Alaska's agencies typically go farther than they have to, but it still isn't far enough. He's introducing a bill this legislative session that would significantly tighten state restrictions. It would limit the use of firefighting foams with PFAS in them and create stricter protective standards for people. He says it's a start.
You know, unfortunately, I nothing in my bill can create the kind of instant understanding and solidly defensible cleanup standards that we need to get these contaminated water plumes cleaned up under the ground.
There's federal legislation in the works this year that could set nationwide regulations for PFAS. But until any of those bills become law, folks from Gustavus are pretty much left to advocate for themselves. Nicole Gruey says state regulators have responded to some of her requests for additional testing near the airport, but not all of them.
So does it allay all my fears? No. Am I hoping for a good outcome? Yes. And I hope that we've created enough noise that the DOT is going to double down on making sure there's no additional risk to Gustavus, you know?
Until more regulations are set, making noise is about all she or anyone can do. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Claire Strempel.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. A first-ever Alaska aquaculture semester takes students to the water. More after this.
Halibut and black cod buyers and sellers, simplify your sales online from one location at the Seafood Auction. Visit seafoodauction.net.
A first-ever field-based Alaskan aquaculture semester in Sitka is being offered this fall to students in Alaska and across the nation. It's part of the University of Alaska at Southeast Fisheries Technology Program that's been preparing students for jobs throughout the fishing industry since 2009. It focuses on training in aquaculture and salmon enhancement and fisheries management. Angie Bowers is an assistant professor with the Fish Tech program.
Students will come here and experience Sitka and be able to get 13 credits of instruction with courses in salmon culture and mariculture and also in cold water survival. And they're going to learn how to drive boats and fix motors and tie knots and how to be safe. And they'll also be able to do an internship. And that can be kind of based on whatever they're interested in.
There are three salmon hatcheries in the region where students will help with egg takes and learn about fish pathology and rearing. Bowers says they'll also be introduced to shellfish and kelp farming.
Because of the timing of the semester, that's not the typical growing season for kelp, but we will be able to identify species of kelp, and we have the ability at the university to make the seed string that gets outplanted on the kelp farm, and we will be visiting an oyster farm, and so we'll try to incorporate as much mariculture experience as we can.
The Fish Tech program is the university's only 1- and 2-year entry-level applied fisheries program. Director Joel Marcus said there's been a tenfold growth since it began 12 years ago in Ketchikan, and graduates now work for agencies or organizations across Alaska and in the lower 48. state, only 12 students will be accepted for the fall semester that starts on August 23rd and runs through December. Google Salmon Culture Semester to learn more and find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon, Kodiak. It's your Island Messenger for today's noon show. Let's get right into the weather. At present, it is mostly cloudy, 37 degrees Fahrenheit here in Kodiak. For this afternoon, mostly cloudy with a high near 39. A west wind of 5 to 10 miles per hour becoming light and variable. For tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 33, a west wind of 10 to 20 miles per hour. For Saturday, partly sunny with a high near 46, a west wind around 15 miles per hour. Saturday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 35, a west wind of 5 to 10 miles per hour. Sunday, mostly cloudy with a high near 43, a southwest wind of 5 to 15 miles per hour. For Sunday night, a chance of rain after 10 p.m. mixing with snow after 1 a.m. Mostly cloudy with a low around 31, a calm wind becoming northeast around 5 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 50%. And then coming into the upcoming week on Monday, a chance of rain and snow before 10 a.m., partly sunny with a high near 40, chance of precipitation is 50%. And for Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 28. Then for Homer, it is fair, 28 degrees Fahrenheit at present. For this afternoon, mostly cloudy with a high near 32, a calm wind becoming southwest around 5 miles per hour. For tonight, a 30% chance of snow, mainly after 1 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 24, a south wind of 5 to 10 miles per hour. And for Saturday, a chance of snow before 10 a.m., then a chance of rain between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., then a chance of rain and snow after 4 p.m. Cloudy with a high near 40, a southwest wind of 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts as high as 20 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 30%. And for tomorrow night, a chance of rain and snow before 10 p.m., then a chance of rain and snow after 4 a.m. Cloudy with a low around 30, a southwest wind around 10 miles per hour with gusts as high as 20 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 30%. For Anchorage, 26 degrees Fahrenheit and a few clouds in the sky. For this afternoon, partly sunny with a high near 27 with calm wind. For tonight, a 40% chance of snow after 2 a.m., increasing clouds with a low around 15, a calm wind becoming east around 5 miles per hour after midnight. For Saturday, a 30% chance of snow, mainly before 11 a.m., cloudy with a high near 35, an east wind of 5 to 10 miles per hour. And for tomorrow night, a 40% chance of snow, cloudy with a low around 26, a south wind of 5 to 10 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 20 miles per hour. It is Good Friday right now. It is the 2nd of April of 2021. The sun rose today at 7:34 a.m. It will set tonight at 8:54 p.m., and it will rise again tomorrow at 7:31 a.m. For Kodiak District tides, we had a high tide at 5:37 a.m. of 9.68 feet. In 2 minutes, no. At 12:25 p.m. there will be a low tide of negative 0.71 feet, a high tide at 6:53 p.m. of 6.46 feet, a low tide at 12:06 a.m. of 2.5 feet, and a high tide at 6:27 a.m. of 9.06 feet. For the west side tides, a high at 6:03 a.m. at 16.02 feet, a low tide at 12:48 p.m. of negative 1.25 feet, a high tide at 7:11 p.m. of 13.07 feet, a low tide at 12:57 a.m. of 3.24 feet, and a high tide at 6:52 a.m. of 14.55 feet. We're at 13 hours and 20 minutes of daylight with a gain of 4 minutes and 59 seconds. The record high was 54 degrees in 1926, and the record low was 10 in 1985. For the marine weather, for the synopsis of the North Gulf Coast and Kodiak Island waters, low pressure lingers across the Gulf through tonight. 1,013 millibar low forms 104 nautical miles southwest of Cordova on Saturday morning and moves to 144 nautical miles southeast of Cordova at 1,018 millibars by Saturday evening. For Marmot Islands to Sitkanak, a small craft advisory through Saturday. A west wind of 25 knots for today, seas to 7 feet with freezing spray. For tonight, a west wind of 25 knots, seas to 7 feet. For Saturday, a west wind of 25 knots, seas to 6 feet. For Saturday night, a west wind of 30 knots, seas to 9 feet. For Sunday, a west wind of 30 knots, seas to 10 feet. And for Monday through Tuesday, a northwest wind of 35 knots, seas to 11 feet. For the Shelikoff Strait, small craft advisory through Saturday and heavy freezing spray warning today. For today, west wind of 30 knots, seas to 7 feet, heavy freezing spray in the morning. For tonight, a southwest wind of 30 knots, seas to 7 feet. For Saturday, a southwest wind of 25 knots, seas to 6 feet. For Saturday night, a southwest wind of 25 knots, seas to 7 feet. For Sunday, a west wind of 30 knots, seas to 8 feet. Monday, a west wind of 25 knots, seas to 5 feet. And Tuesday, a west wind of 30 knots, seas to 7 feet. For some community announcements, the Kodiak City Council will hold a work session on Tuesday, April 6th, 2021 at 7:30 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library Multipurpose Room. This meeting is open to the public and will be broadcasted here on KMXT 100.1 FM and web streamed on the city website. The web streaming link, agendas, and meeting packets are available online at cityofkodiak.civicweb.net/portal. To request paper copies of the packet or for additional information, call the city clerk's office at 486-8636. The Kodiak City Council will hold a regular meeting on Thursday, April 8th of 2021 at 7:30 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library Multipurpose Room. This meeting is open to the public and will be broadcasted on KMXT 100.1 FM and web-streamed on the city website. The web-streaming link, agendas, and meeting packets are available online at cityofkodiak.civicweb.net/portal. To request paper copies of the packet or for additional information, call the city clerk's office at 486-8636. From the United States Department of the Interior, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is accepting proposals to conduct commercial sport fishing guide services on the Eugenic River drainage located within the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. The service will award special use permits to successful applicants through a competitive selection process. The permits will allow sport fish guide services in specific refuge use areas through December 31st of 2026. Proposals must be mailed to Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge at 1390 Buskin River Road in Kodiak by 4:30 p.m. April 15th of 2020. For more information, call 907-487-2600.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.